It's cozy season, and nothing compares to wrapping yourself in a Minky Couture blanket. Luxuriously soft, perfectly warm, thoughtfully made. From movie nights to chilly mornings, Minky Couture turns everyday moments into pure comfort. Once you feel it, you'll understand why it's called the original best blanket ever. Visit MinkyCouture.com or a store near you and make this cozy season your softest one yet.
Welcome to Look for the Light, a podcast where we dive into the world of The Last of Us. I'm your host, Stuart Traynor, and I'm joined, as always, by someone who has seen every Curtis and Viper movie at least three times and definitely pulls her punches when sparring. It's Jess Sterling. Jess, how are you doing?
I feel like both of those things are just so untrue. I don't know that I would pull a punch while fighting, and I definitely am not seeing whatever these action movies are that they're talking about.
I mean, you did confuse James Bond and Mission Impossible recently. I will shame you publicly.
Put that on a public forum. Listen. Those are what I like to refer to as car movies, meaning things that I don't watch. It's like action-y. There's cars. They're racing. I don't watch any of that stuff. So, yes, I did confuse Mission Impossible and James Bond because, let's face it, they're like the same genre. They're very similar, right? One's British, one's not.
Similar-ish, yeah. But like, I think putting this up front, like an aversion to action, probably going to like not fare well for probably the next episode that's coming up, perhaps, because it looks like it's going to be a doozy, does it not?
This is different, okay? Yeah. This is like prestige TV. If something is prestige TV, I don't care what the genre is. We'll be checking it out, okay?
If it's got the HBO logo at the beginning, then we can just ignore all the other
stuff. I'm not trying to be an elitist or anything, but yes, if HBO is going to do it, I will watch it.
Gosh, I am so thankful that we're finally at this point. This has been like the longest build-up. We started podcasting, we recapped season one, we had a couple of episodes where we dove into the trailers, we went through the entirety of the second game, which was a hefty one. And now we're finally here, season two is upon us. Jess, what were your initial impressions of this episode?
I loved it. I loved it so much. I'm so happy to be back. I feel like the things that we were looking for from the game to be included were included. The changes that we talked about kind of wanting to see, establishing the character of Abby earlier on than they would do in the video game. We'll talk about it when we get to the spoiler section. But the casting, Dina! Mm-hmm. I have a feeling I will be shouting Dina's name constantly throughout season two because I love the character of Dina so much. I feel like she was done justice on this episode of television. They're setting up so much. The new additions, Gail, I can't wait to talk about her. I just thought this was a perfect return to form for The Last of Us, and I'm so thrilled it's back and so excited to see what we have in store for us for this season. What about you, Stuart? Big thoughts.
Incredible episode of TV. I think that they covered so much while also not really covering that much in the same way. It was really dense, a lot of new things, which have been really exciting. I think some great departures from the game. Some I'm not entirely sold on, so it's not an entirely glowing kind of perspective, but I'm certainly not down on it. I adored this episode of TV, so much so that I've watched it multiple times since it has aired. This has been, I'm just incredibly high on this, and I'm really excited to jump in to talk about it. But before we do get started, if you're listening for the first time, please make sure you're subscribed wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like a more visual experience, we are also on YouTube where you can see our lovely faces at Look for the Light Pod there, as well as on all the socials there as well with the same username. We also love to hear what you think, what your thoughts are on the episodes, what theories you may have, or any other feedback. So do please reach out for us at lookforthelightpodcast@gmail.com. And don't worry, we won't spoil anything ahead or anything from the games. We'll focus for the most parts of this pod on what happens in this week's episode. And if you're looking to dive into the deeper story with the context of the games in comparison, then you can stick around for the end where we have our spoiler section. But unless you've got anything else you want to chime in with, Jess, should we get going?
Let's do it.
Swear to me that everything you said about the Fireflies is true.
I swear.
We open up immediately where we left off with the same scene from the close of season one with okay. And then we just see what happens afterwards, which is, I love that choice for me personally, because it kind of almost, it's so strange because we've seen it in the video games. We've seen it obviously in season one now. We've seen just that conversation and the build up and then the okay and then cut credits. But there is just an awkwardness of just, well, then what? Do they talk further? Does it like walk away as we did see happen? Very, very interesting choice, I thought.
Yeah, this makes perfect sense. This is exactly what happens in the video game. I think it also kind of sets the scene, sets the tone of what's at stake here, reminds viewers who maybe didn't rewatch season one ahead of time, aren't obsessed with the show, where we left off, and like kind of sets us up for things aren't going to be so hunky-dory between Ellie and Joel. I think, you know, we can read a lot into the okay, and as we did in the last podcast. Mm-hmm. And I love that we're picking things up where we left things off. I think it's a perfect choice to start out this way, especially because the very next scene that we're going to talk about does not have Ellie nor Joel in it. And I do think it's very important to start season two back up with Ellie and Joel. I don't think you want to start the season with an Abby scene, you know?
Yeah. And I appreciate it as well, because it's not just returning back to like, oh, here's what happened last season. It's doing that while also still embellishing that scene a little bit. We're getting a little bit of like more insight into it. And I think you get just another example of just how much must have been left on the cutting room floor of just how brilliant Pedro Pascal is, because there is that reaction of just almost like a look of, oh gosh, she sees right through it. And I have to just stick to this now. And this kind of like resignment that, okay, this is how it's going to be. And this is the line that has to be followed. And just that almost like, oh, okay, this will be fun to deal with. Yeah. And they just get on with it, which I think is just a very brave choice.
All right, let's talk about how. Because here's what we got. He's a smuggler. His name's Joel or Joe. There's some confusion about that.
50s, graying, beard, 6 foot tall, scar on his right temple. Oh, yeah, they said he's handsome. I forgot. With a 3-day jump on us, we should have gone right after him.
He drove away, Abby, in our only working vehicle.
And we were trying to save the wounded. But we didn't save anyone. Did we?
You mentioned the following scene. We finally get Abby under some really tough circumstances, understandably. This is a big departure from the games. This is an entirely kind of new scene where we get to see the graves of those who were killed last season. This was harrowing.
Yeah, I think this is a perfect way to establish Abby and the remaining Fireflies. First of all, you know, and what we'll talk about video game comparisons, but I think setting up who Abby is as a character and what her motivations are, while it's not necessary in a video game format, it is in a television format. We need to have investment into this character, showing her right away and also showing her right after we have this conversation with Ellie and Joel talking about the hospital scene and the Fireflies, and then establishing Abby is a Firefly. Joel killed most of the Fireflies that were there in Salt Lake City. So establishing who she is and what her motivations are for wanting to hunt down Joel, I think is extremely necessary in the beginning of the season. So I was really happy to see it. I also feel like you and I, Stuart, both were like, we could recognize who every single one of the people in this scene was, which was really exciting. I feel like casting did a great job there. I think, you know, we talked a lot about the casting of Abby and like the physicality of Abby as a player in, you know, in the game. And I'm really excited to see what Caitlin can do in this role as Abby. I think right off the bat, we're getting a lot. We're feeling the aggression and emotionality of this character right away, which I was really pleased to see because Abby is an emotional character. You know what I mean? Like, we're going to talk a lot about comparisons between Abby and Ellie, but I do think this is like a perfect establishing scene for a character like Abby.
Yeah, I think it really is. It's a great scene to introduce Abby. My only question is, did we necessarily need this as soon as we got it?
Mm.
I kind of see why they're maybe hedging their bets, because Abby is going to be an important character in this season. We've seen it across, like, we've seen so many clips from the trailers involving Abby. So that obviously there's a bigger story going on here. But I feel like perhaps maybe some of this could have come a little bit later. But it was still, to me, like, incredible the way in which they kind of captured just that visceral rage that Abby has for the loss of who she's grieving, and the inner party conflicts going on with people kind of like wanting to rebuild almost and move on, and she's there going, no, we need to find him. We need to stop wasting time. And there was a lot of it. Like, she's even throwing some barbs at what are quite clearly her close friends here, that don't seem to be like kind of well received by them, which is kind of layering, I think, some really kind of cool dynamics going on here with what I'm guessing are very like five very kind of unique perspectives on what is ultimately revealed at the end of the episode to be a very shared goal, as they seem to be on a long journey heading to where Jackson is. There's some lovely touches here, and I think we might kind of get onto those in video game spoiler chat later on, but I was just, again, just the way in which we went back to have the drafts from season one as well, to frame that context as well. I mean, rewards people for paying attention to these like kind of things. Like, yeah, the draft's probably a bit of a slap around the face, but it's like good to reward people for having a remembrance of continuity from the last season rather than having to have it by flashbacks, which was one of my criticisms of season one, especially in episode one, where we had the flashback from the same episode to convey Joel's PTSD. Yeah. I like to think that they're giving a bit more respect to the viewer this time around, which I do appreciate.
Yeah, I agree. I love the callback to the giraffes. I mean, I'm never going to be mad to be seeing giraffes on my TV, you know?
Yeah.
Boom, motherfucker.
First of all, okay means stop.
Sorry, I was in the moment.
Second, you can't boom, motherfucker, people who land a first hit on you. Square in the face, by the way.
Well, I can obviously take a punch, so who cares? Fucking hard, by the way.
I pulled it.
You pulled it?
Yeah, he pulled it.
Why?
Because I told him to.
Why?
Otherwise, he would have knocked you out. And I don't want to have to explain that to Joel.
Don't do that again.
How do we feel about the combat training going on? What was your thoughts when you first started watching this, Jess? Because it opens and it's almost like you think Ellie's getting her ass kicked, right?
Yeah, this is perfect. You know, in the listening to the official Last of Us podcast that HBO puts out, they were talking about needing to show how someone as small as Bella Ramsey has fought and over these, you know, 5 years that we're gonna see that we've jumped in time, how she's able to take down someone larger than her, how Ellie is able to, like, you know, they said she learned some jujitsu to be able to take this guy down. And on top of that, we're going to talk about, as always, we're talking a lot about violence and kind of being energized by violence. And I love getting to see that while Ellie did suffer a punch to the face, after that, she's essentially perfect. And when this guy, you know, hits the ground, says, I'm done, you know, cries uncle, essentially, Ellie doesn't let up. She's not all there. And it reminds me of the season one episode with David, where she doesn't stop right away. You know, she kind of goes somewhere else when she's in this kind of violent streak. And I think they're establishing, like, this is still the Ellie that we know, but she's even more dangerous now because now she has combat training.
Yeah. And I love the fact that we are relying on like kind of jiu-jitsu to take people down, like to get into those like kind of holds that are just difficult to get out of. No matter strength, it's all about leverage. It's all about positioning.
Yes.
And especially being kind of like young, nimble, flexible, like it's so dangerous if they're like latch onto you. Such a weird thing of context. One of my favorite pro wrestlers is a guy called Zack Sabre Jr., who he's out in Japan and he goes up against these big hulking guys, but his whole wrestling style is all about that kind of like, oh, you're gonna throw a limb to me, well I'm gonna grab hold of it and I'm not gonna let go. Yes. And I think that's certainly the approach we're gonna get here, and it makes so much sense from a storytelling perspective of like, well, how is she going to take on like big hulking brutes if she does go up against them? From two things. One, it's going to be that kind of like technical combat, but it's also going to be just a resilience. She gets knocked in the face and just continues, like shakes it off and just gets on with it. And this is a great thing to establish really early, because you know we're going to get those criticisms from like people online.
Sure.
Just, oh, she's a little girl. How does she do this?
Yeah. Yeah. It's very frustrating to even consider that that is going to be a criticism. However, I will say this, the way Bella Ramsey is playing Ellie is so true to the video game, where Ellie is like a dexterity type of fighter. Like she's, she's quick. She's agile. You know, she is, as opposed to, you know, what we're talking about, Abby is more muscle, right? Same thing with Joel. Like there's three very different fighting styles represented in these three different characters, and getting to see that, them establishing very early on in season two, like, no, Ellie is a force to be reckoned with now more than ever. And getting to see how upset Ellie gets when she finds out that Caleb pulled the first punch on her.
Yeah.
I also loved, because I think we were establishing Ellie as someone who's like, absolutely don't do that again. Like, no, punch me for real. Right. She's strong. She wants to be taken seriously. And also the reasoning behind them pulling the punches, well, Joel told me to. And how much that bothers Ellie, right? Like we're really seeding a lot of underlying tension here perfectly.
Yeah, the whole thing of like autonomy, what with Ellie now being 19 and being an adult and still having this overbearing paternal figure in her life, so much so that Jesse is afraid to say something that might kind of anger Joel. It's not about protecting Ellie, it's about not pissing Joel off, which says so much about the dynamic at play here. And yeah, to show that Ellie is not here for that immediately is, again, so great, because we come off from the conversation and then we jump straight into finding that out, and then we get Jackson and then we get everything else that follows. It doesn't leave this kind of like, oh, have things healed since that moment? No, immediately it's underlining, oh, I don't think they have. I think maybe they might have got worse. So certainly a great kind of setup from there.
I mean, what did I do?
I don't know.
Yeah, well, I can't hold myself responsible for another person's emotional state.
Are you in fucking therapy?
We finally get to see Joel. This was fantastic. And I'm sorry to say, Pedro, but you were absolutely outshone by the introduction of Dina. Because Dina is a ray of sunshine.
It was bound to happen, though, right? I mean, Dina, this is exactly who Dina is in the video game. And getting this scene, which is new to the show, and establishing a relationship between Joel and Dina, especially when we're able to very quickly compare it to the relationship between Joel and Ellie, where Joel calls Dina kiddo, that felt so massive to me. Not even just as like a bait and switch, you think he's talking to Ellie and it turns out he's talking to Dina, but like, okay, he's not only calling Dina kiddo, he mentions his daughter in front of Dina, which is huge for a character like Joel, who couldn't even talk about his daughter when traveling across the country with Ellie. Like, to go from you know, to be able to see that that is where Joel and Dina's relationship currently is, and have him, we'll talk later, have him kind of comparing, oh, Dina's this great kid. She listens to me. Like, she respects me. She tells me things. I really love that. I thought this was such a great scene, not only as an introduction to the character of Dina and just establishing who she is, but to have the relationship between Joel and Dina established and comparing it to the relationship with Joel and Ellie. It all worked for me so well. And of course, he's doing what he always does. He's the contractor, you know, he's working. He's doing what he has to do.
Well, the foreman isn't foremaning. Joel seems to be almost like they seem to be seeding in this idea that Joel is perhaps a little bit more focused and distracted from things that he should be focused on. He seems to be like hyperfixating over the breakers when really he should be out there foremaning and helping the rest of them out. Yes, what he's doing is useful, but is it absolutely necessary? Who can say? And also, like, the slight thing of him, I saw him like kind of moving his hands, almost like implying that he's got a bit of arthritis, laboring this point of, like, time has passed and Joel is an older man now, like, and that is gonna play a hand into like everything that's going on. Dina though is fascinating. The way in which Dina manages to strip down the walls that Joel has, and maybe he's more reciprocal to it because he is wanting that from Ellie and Dina is a like a sufficient replacement. But Dina seems to get how people tick. Like, Dina seems to be very kind of like activated by interactions with people. We never get a single thing with Dina. It's always in like play with other people, and it's always like playful banter. And it's because she's an absolute people person, and that's like her, almost like her currency that she deals in is just kind of like, well, okay, this is how I'm going to get to you. Like, and so it was great to see her have that dynamic with Joel, but she just asks all the right questions, which means she's so good at it. Like, she asks, like she says, oh, teach me. Like, she knows that Joel wants someone to like fulfill that role. And so she just like goes along with it. She knows that he likes Curtis and Viper. And so she has plans to like go watch him with him later. Like, it's so great to see that. And again, like, not to spot video games, but like in the games, we do get this coming out from like more exposition. We don't really get a Joel Dina scene like this. So this was fantastic. And again, fleshes out Jackson so that it's much more real and lived in as well.
This is a community, right? It's a community of people. And you have to, like, you know, even though we didn't get this scene in the video game, well, Dina and Ellie are best friends. Naturally, Joel would have a relationship with Dina as a result, especially if they're on the same sort of jobs together. They're going to have that back and forth. So to show it, again, show, don't tell. It, you know, it's not always possible in video games. This is why we can do adaptations and slightly change things. And who doesn't want to see these two actors in a scene together? You know, they're both incredible in this scene. So it's really exciting. Dina is the best. And I love that this is the first scene we get of her because, again, she's incredible. This is exactly who Dina is. It's great. I love it.
Actually, taking you off patrols for a bit. Putting you on gate watch.
Gate watch? What? Why?
Oh, because it's an important job.
It's standing on a fucking fence.
He's concerned about you.
Unfucking real.
You know, last run, you were a bit reckless.
It was two runners and a clicker who barely had teeth. I handled it. Isn't that the job?
You want it off on your own, Ellie. We have rules for reasons.
Oh, please. Dina does this shit all the time. No one's putting her on the fucking fence.
We then get Ellie and Tommy out sniping together. Again, another great scene where we get two people having a great conversation together. I love the fact that there is like a strong connection between Ellie and Tommy. Like, it does feel as if Ellie has been brought in as part of the family, even though things seem to be strained with Joel. Her relationship with Tommy is fairly good. And he's like taking on a real kind of mentorship role with her. Again, probably because Joel is perhaps retracting away from the violence, whereas Tommy seems to be embracing it a hell of a lot. Like, he even says to his kid, like, later on, he's like, oh, killer. Like, Tommy seems to embrace that a bit, and I think that probably certainly leads to Ellie feeling a bit more of a connection with Tommy as well. But their conversation while they're sniping was incredibly telling. I liked the fact that like he's really training her, and again showing that Ellie is proficient with the sniper rifle and a good shooter, or becoming a good shooter. Like everything is lending itself really well to like building Ellie up from being the young, naive little kid who shot someone for the first time in last season to now being someone that is so much more adept to this world and so much more capable of surviving in it.
Yeah, I think this relationship is so interesting because you have Tommy, who's the younger sibling. Joel, we've already established, is the protector. And so, of course, Ellie and Tommy are going to feel a bit of a kinship because they're the people Joel wants to protect. And they don't necessarily feel like they need his protection. And so I think having them bond over something like that and having Tommy be the one to bend and be like, okay, you can go on patrol, even though Joel doesn't want you to. And Ellie being able to manipulate Tommy in that way, right? Like they're leaving the scene and Ellie has that classic little smirk on her face. I think it makes so much sense that Ellie would be like, Joel's pissing me off right now. I'm not really connecting with him. I'll go hang out with Tommy. Tommy respects me. Tommy takes me seriously. Tommy doesn't have this overwhelming need to protect me in the same way that Joel does. And in the same way any 19-year-old wouldn't like. Yes, there are like heavier topics involved here and like bigger stakes, a more dangerous world. But Ellie is still a 19-year-old, and so having her be like, I don't need protection, Joel. Like, I don't need protection, Dad. It makes all the sense in the world, and I love this little scene with these two. It really worked for me. And the setting, right? Like, the gorgeous, like...
Oh, gosh, yes.
Having it, we get to see, like, the rolling mountains and having just, like, this stark white snow against the you know, the clickers and the infected, and then, you know, the gunshots, obviously the blood on the snow. It's all gorgeous.
Yeah, some really great and like kind of scene setting and like kind of backdrops to the whole thing. There's oftentimes I'm watching this and I go, gosh, I'd love to live in Jackson. Like, it's so picturesque. And then I have to remind myself, they're crapping in buckets, and so, like, there's those practicalities. Yeah. Like, things aren't that great.
But I mean, as far as a place to live in this world,
yes,
thumbs up.
Yeah, zombie apocalypse hits, we're going.
But exactly.
We need to build faster.
Faster? Sure. How much faster? See, we got this dial called the constructometer.
Joel,
the more you turn it, the faster we go.
We're running out of space to put these people.
Yeah, I noticed. Maybe your council stopped letting so many of them in.
It's our council. And these people are fleeing collapsed settlements. They're fleeing infected. We're supposed to leave them out there?
If our lifeboat is swamped, yeah, we leave them out there. If I could, I'd let them all in. And I'm working every damn day and night to make more space. You know that. But you got to look after your own first, or you're no good to anyone.
One of the benefits of Jackson is that it is expanding. They're taking on more and more people. And we get this conversation with Joel and Maria. Again, another dynamic being explored, which isn't really kind of like fully fleshed out, and a great way of kind of fleshing out this world. And we get a real... Oh, it's so good to have this like political opposition of like thoughts of like, okay, do we take people on because it's the moral thing to do? And whereas Joel is very much like, no, you fix your own mask first and then you help others. And it's like, neither are necessarily wrong. Both have their own sense of like morality in the whole thing. But both don't get into a screaming match and start refuting each other's positions and doing personal attacks. It's like we have a conflict here, let's try and move through it. Sadly, there isn't a magic constructometer dial that you can just turn. If only there
was,
right?
Dad thing to say, right? Constructometer is out of the dad dictionary. Yeah, I mean, the thing is that they're both right. Maria is right to say Joel was once a refugee as well, and these people are fleeing infected. They need help. We should help them. But Joel's also right that they have a limited amount of resources and they need to help their people first. So it's really tough, right? Like, more people equals, okay, more builders, more people that can do these jobs, more people that can contribute to the community, but also more mouths to feed, more people to house. You can see both sides and they're both right. There's no, you know, one size fits all answer for this sort of a problem. Mm-hmm. I still like that we got the conversation because not only does it set up like the importance of Maria, we already know that from season one, just she's still a very influential member of this community. And now Joel is also a very influential, important member of this community. He has established himself. He's the foreman. He's looking at these blueprints, right? Like he has an important role here. And to kind of have their back and forth, a civil back and forth, I really like seeing, because this is right. This is what would happen. You know, you have to have these sorts of debates about how many people can we realistically allow into the community.
Yeah, it's refreshing to have it not being presented as like a very petty argument that is involving like splitting the family down the line because people disagree on politics. And it's great to have the conversation. It's horrible to really consider that there is truth to it and the applicability to our own world, but and it's the nature of these kind of like tough topics. But I love the way in which Maria corrects Joel when he's like, if your council like keep taking people on, and she's like, it's our council, like reminding him you're part of this community as well, but also taking away that sense of ownership of it being hers, because she wants it to be, it's like it's communist society, like it's everyone's, it's a shared resource. And to kind of like reaffirm that rather than to buy into the yes I am on the council and it is mine kind of thing, which is a great thing to portray, because I think otherwise there could be some resentment towards Maria just being a bit of a kind of like I'm going to control everything and thus I'm going to pick
I love Maria and, Maria's great, especially show Maria. I love how they've added more depth to this character. Mm-hmm. She just seems like a good person. Like she just wants the best for this community that she's built. And she has a bleeding heart for like these people who are outsiders who need help. So I love Maria.
We also got a shot with Benji playing with the toy plane that seems to like crash down, and I was like, I wonder if that's an intentional callback to the first episode of last season, trying to mimic that, which kind of gave me a bit of an amusement, and I was like, oh gosh, trauma. Don't take me back there, please. But Joel leaves, takes off, and seemingly has an appointment, as we've established earlier with the conversation with Dina. It's going to therapy. And we get our first introduction to Gail, who's a fantastic addition to the show, right?
What is this, our fifth session? Are you just going to keep grouching on like this every time?
Aren't you supposed to be validating me or something?
Oh, yeah, actually I am. But I'm not going to do it anymore. Because you're lying to me, and it's exhausting. Yes, you are, Joel. Yes, you are. I've done this long enough to know when somebody is leaving something out, and you are definitely leaving something out. And you want me to validate that? No. In fact, fuck no.
I mean, you cannot go wrong with Catherine O'Hara. Like, she could play anybody. She could do anything. I feel so confidently about that. This character is incredible. Not only for the fact of, like, listen, we would need therapists. We need therapists now. We certainly would need them in a post-apocalyptic world, especially when we have a community that just feels like something you would have. And to get to hear kind of what Joel puts out as like his emotional reflections is incredible. But on top of that, to have there be strife between a therapist and their patient, because again, they live in a small community. They're all very intrinsically linked to one another. Played beautifully by Catherine O'Hara. I already love the character of Gail. I mean, I kind of already loved her before she said a single word because it's Catherine O'Hara. But on top of that, being that the exchange for services and goods is weed, killed me. To know that she has such a difficult relationship with Joel because of the death of her husband, Eugene, who we'll definitely be talking about in the spoiler section. But I just love it. I think this back and forth was, I don't know if it was my favorite scene of the episode, but definitely up there. I think it sets up a lot and just goes to show, like, Joel's not being honest, both with himself and others, right? Like, I think he said to himself for 5 years now, I did what I had to do. Everything I did was justified. I think you tell yourself that enough times and you start to believe it, right? Like, he can't say the truth for many reasons. One of which is he doesn't really buy that, like, he didn't have to do what he did. In his mind, he absolutely had to do what he did.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating to see that, like, Gale is so in command, really, despite being as erratic as she is, because she's kind of like, she's just lost all the F's to give, really. She sees through this, like, so transparently. Joel is like a textbook case of someone that is creating a problem that is there as a front for the underlying issue. And she's just like, why are we wasting each other's time? Let's just get to it. Like, say the thing that you're afraid to say. Like, what did you do? And he just plants in the ground, like, says, no, this is the line I'm not going to cross. I saved her, and then that's it. Doesn't go into the actual technicalities of everything, reiterates it. But the way in which it's played to such a depth where he stands up with almost like a, right, this is what is going to be said, and she flinches. Gosh, the terror in that moment. Because really, like, he's killed her husband. And yet he is a dangerous person. And I think, like, there's so much to wrap up with this whole conversation of just like, well, yeah, okay, Joel is certainly upset about Ellie, and there is, like, that underlying problem, but there's also this whole thing of him having to deal with what he's done. It's not just about the lie, it's about what he did, which is horrible. And he is reconciling that, or at least reconciling it in the best way that he can, which is to completely avoid it. But it does show that, like, other people sense that violence in him. Like, Gale certainly does. Gale knows what he's capable of, even if she doesn't know the full extent of the truth with that. And the way in which she flinches was just, to me, just such, so well done, because I genuinely saw a bit of, like, fear in that. And it's a testament to, like, Gale is so funny beforehand as well, and the way in which she, like, has articulated that she just doesn't give an F anymore. And comedy actors are the only people that can do this. Like, it's the whole Vince Gilligan mindset of things. It's like, this is why you cast people in these roles. It's just so, so great. For me, I think this was one of my favorite scenes as well. I'm not entirely sure if it's the top, but it's certainly up there. And I'm so appreciative of adding it.
And part of it is Pedro Pascal with his single tear is just moving, right? How actually dare he do this to us? Everything about it is so moving. You believe that he believes, like, you know, it's like he wants to say it, but even speaking it will prove that what he did wasn't the right thing, or make him feel like it wasn't the right thing. I love this. And I love that Gale sees through the BS. I love that she is able to call him out on it and be like, you're lying to me, and you have been lying to me. And how long are we going to go on with this? Because I've already had a few drinks today and I'm not in the mood. So I'm going to just say it. I love that. I think that's kind of the therapist Joel needs. Even if it is maybe not how they normally would do things. I feel like you kind of throw the handbook out the window at a certain point.
When someone's done a mass shooting in a hospital, I think you can probably throw out the guidebook, right? I think you might have to go to some other.
I mean, and killed your husband.
Killed your husband. And brought you shaken stems. How dare he?
Where's the stickiness, Joel? Even in the winter, guys? Eugene would know how to do this, and you suck at this. Love it. Yeah, it was great.
She with all that hardware. Hey, like Curtis and Viper. You know, those movies Joel likes?
Yeah, I know.
I was actually going to maybe watch them tomorrow night with him, if you want to join.
Patrol?
Yeah. Yeah, Patrol.
cut to Ellie playing Love Buzz by Nirvana loud, like an absolute kind of like teenager would. This was, again, a great bit of fan service. We get Ellie tinkering at a workstation table, like fixing the guns, which is a big mechanic from the second game. And we get the first interaction with Ellie and Dina. We get the first inklings of flirtation going on. This, for me, wasn't my favorite scene in terms of it being profound and meaningful. It was just more in the fact that I was just there as a fan of the games, just going, they're doing this, like bringing it all together. So thankful for this. What did you think of this?
Yeah, they have such great chemistry immediate chemistry. Any person who maybe isn't aware of the video game or is aware of the video games but haven't played them, you know, doesn't know the plot, doesn't know all of that stuff, immediately you're like, okay, kiss, just kiss immediately. Like they're so perfect together. Again, the way Dina is meant to be this sort of bubbly, extroverted character that Ellie just so clearly isn't. And they work so well together because of that, because Ellie is a little bit more serious, but can lighten up and joke and have banter with Dina, because Dina is this like magnetic personality who just brightens up any room she walks into. And you can feel that immediately in this scene. I love it. I love that we're also establishing Dina kind of poking and prodding about the Joel thing. Like she knows something's up. So she's trying to tempt Ellie with like a movie night of this Curtis and Viper action series. I love it. It makes perfect sense. And yeah, we've already established they're best friends, but it's like, they're best friends and there's something going on. There's something happening here. And it's very exciting. I love it.
Yeah, the poking and the prodding is certainly something that I appreciated most from this. Firstly, just from you've got as much time as you need. 2 minutes. Like, just again, just asserting a little bit of authority and pushing Ellie to like kind of perhaps annoy, perhaps kind of just assert a bit of authority. But then equally just dogging Ellie for the absolute like gung-ho mentality of just, well, I'll take everything. If I can carry it, I'm going to wield it. Was just hilarious. I love it. And again, like we get them departing and Ellie grabbing the switchblade as well, which was like jammed into the side cabinet, which is again from the game, and a lovely touch for that for fans. There's a lot of fan service going on in this episode, which was deeply, deeply appreciated from that. We get more sass coming from the patrol team briefing as well. We get a different kind though. We get more flirtation, I feel, as well, between Dina and Jesse, which was, again, so great because then it illustrates just that lingering look of jealousy from Ellie. Like, she looked like, I'm not a fan of that.
We haven't really talked about this, but Jesse is hot. Like, am I allowed to say this? He is so ripped and just like, so he's in a position of authority. Ellie has established he's like a couple years older than them. Like, I would be jealous of Jesse too. I'd be jealous of Nina. I'd be jealous of all of them. It's also good looking
to be hot in an apocalypse.
Oh, yeah. Like, look at him. Oh, he's telling me what to do. Jesse, don't stop.
I love it. The moment, like, kind of we were digging through the like trailers, or like it was when the photos came out. And I remember just there being all caps messages of just arms.
Look at his arms.
Like, Jesse is beefy.
He's got guns. Like, he's, you know, we'll talk about in video game comparisons, but he's a very sweet character, is like how I would describe him. So to see like this sweet guy coming in with these like muscles, I was like, whoa, Jesse, calm down with those guns, my guy. Yeah.
Loved it. Ellie's not the only one packing with like
but to establish him as like this like figure of authority, and have him kind of Ellie and Dina be like the kids in the back of the class like goofing off. I love what it sets up, because again, it's just like Ellie and Dina versus the world in a sort of a way.
Yeah. We then get them leaving. They establish the mechanism that we'd seen in the previous season with the bandana colors, with a color representing whether it's good or bad to return back with, which is a great, another like practicality to the whole thing of the patrol system that they seem to have going out. And they go out on recon. We get the whole team going out, led by Kat, the other one.
So awful. I mean, I get it because it's a small community, but stop it. Mm-hmm. Don't call her the other one. Stop.
I was just mortified hearing that. So bad. But again, we get Dina probing Ellie, pushing for like kind of the answers, like, are you taking anyone tonight? Are you coming tonight? Maybe you should take Kat. We established that there was a bit of history, that Kat left her mark, reference to the tattoo that we've seen as well, confirmation of that being the source of it. Again, a great dynamic between these two, just establishing that they are besties, they know each other very well, they kind of have conversations like this, but there is this tension just between them that you could, I don't know, like Dina must see it, right?
I think this is Dina poking to get information, right? Because she's mm-hmm. asking about Kat and, oh, are you bringing anyone? And of course, they're friends, so you could easily kind of mask it in that way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is, see, because she does say like, oh, I see that look. You like someone else. This is a classic way to find out if someone's interested in you. You know, mm-hmm. like you gotta, oh, are you interested in anybody? Ooh. Wink, wink. Yeah, that's what Dina's doing. Dina's just doing it in a very like extroverted way. You probably wouldn't find Ellie doing this, but this is exactly what Dina would do to be like, I want to just find out, you know, is she interested? Yeah. Did anybody?
Dina will throw the question out there and wait for an answer. Ellie would be there, maybe I'll write it in a note and then ask you to check a box.
Don't F it up. Yeah, that's Ellie.
Exactly.
Hey, can we go back now, please?
Yeah, we will. Promise. We're just going to listen quick, see if any are in there, which is definitely recon. And, you know, maybe there's a regular person who's trapped and needs help.
Yeah, what if there's a family in there? What if there's a toddler? Or a baby. There's no babies in there.
Eventually, though, they find a blood trail which leads them towards the supermarket. Again, very faithful to the games, this whole situation. And we find that, in fact, they've taken down a bear, which, again, just immediately shows you the brutality and the strength of what they're going up against. Yeah, it's a couple of, like, a number of them, but it wasn't a horde. It was only a handful, and they took down a freaking bear. Like, that's not something that people could do, which is insane.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, this would be terrifying to most people. To Ellie and Dina, it's like they come alive at this. Like, they're excited mm-hmm. at the prospect of this. Immediately, they want to go in the building. They want to explore. They want to see if there are any infected in there, against protocol, against Kat's orders, against Jesse's orders. You know, they don't
want... What if there's a toddler or a baby?
I love that line so much. What if there's a baby that needs our help?
Yeah, there's no babies in there.
It's so perfect. We see them climb a car or a truck, which is, again, really awesome to see because of the video game. And I like that we're establishing that Dina is, I'm not going to say the brain of the operation, because I think Ellie and Dina are both very intelligent, but in terms of Ellie wanting to jump in, ask questions later, and Dina kind of waiting and being like, oh, no, it's one. No, there's two. You know what I mean? Yeah. Being able to count how many she's hearing. And, you know, alongside that, I love the kind of silent game of charades they're playing, where, you know, they have like almost like the military signals of like, okay, you're going to do this, I'm going to do this. It both sets up that they're a really great team with like an established communication style, and also that they probably have had some sort of training in this, that you know, the patrol people have been well versed in how do we communicate silently to one another in situations mm-hmm. where that's necessary, around things like clickers, where they're relying on sound to find you.
But it's also not entirely serious. Like they show an effectiveness to it, but then they start goofing off. Like Ellie's miming, like stabbing and all of that stuff. It shows that like it's still Ellie from the first season. And like, yeah, she had that profound situation with David and with everything that happened in Salt Lake City, and this lie that has been like kind of kept for all this time. But still, it's still Ellie. And she's going to make stupid goofball jokes that are so inappropriate because they could die at any moment being in here. But they take the risk. It works out okay. We find out that Ellie is pro-bottle and not brick, which was delightful. I'm so happy about that.
Team Bottle Assemble, baby!
Yeah, bricks perhaps are more powerful. Bottles, they're louder. They seem louder.
And also, do you know what you can... I mean, not really in the game, but in real life. You know what you can make out of a bottle is a Molotov cocktail, which is like my favorite weapon in the game, is a Molotov cocktail, baby.
Chuck it. Good. Lure them in. Get a bit stabby. Deal with the problem. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Shows that they are absolutely able and capable of dealing with these situations. What they're not able to deal with is Ellie falling through the floor again.
Ellie, girl, stop. Come on. You gotta be more careful.
We had it last season with the infected, the suicide guy in episode 7 that fell through the floor. And we're getting it again this time, but with Ellie falling ass first into the snack section of a supermarket.
Floors just aren't what they used to be, you know? Like, no. The contractors are terrible. They're not good at making floors.
Joel would never.
No. But he would be like, oh, the structural integrity of this supermarket is trash. And we get, oh my God. Watch. I've seen this episode twice now, and I was on the edge of my seat even in the second time watching, because I just know how I handled the stalkers in the game and how much they terrified me. They were like my least favorite infected to go up against because of how stealthy they are, because of how smart they are. And having Ellie encounter one, not knowing to expect this, is so scary, right? She's used to being able to make noise and attract one and then take it out. To have one creeping up on her, horrifying, scary. To see it like creeping in the background behind her, the way they shot it, ooh, I hated it and I loved it all at once.
Yeah, it's incredible. It shows how effective this can be, because in a video game you're very kind of like focused on your character. It's tough to do more background kind of like creepy things that you can like see just in the periphery. It's so much easier to do this in a kind of well-established shot like they have done, and they use it to full effect. The anxiety that they got from this scene was phenomenal, and props to like the prosthetics as well. We had tendrils coming out of the nose that was kind of like ripped off. We had the scarring from quite obviously the bear claws from the attack that just again leads to a continuity. Like the greasy hair, everything,
the spore crown
looked so well done. And just again, it's like it speaks to the budget of everything here. And of course, we could have had Ellie being attacked by multiple monsters here, but it's not that's scary. It's like all it takes is one to get bit, and again, it's reaffirming that is a legitimate risk. And Ellie does get bit again.
Girl, stop. This is when Dina, who's pretty much as impulsive as you are, says, Ellie, stay still and don't move. I don't know. Maybe stay still and don't move. You know, like maybe she still would have gotten bitten. But like, put your back up against a wall. Go into a corner. Stand there and look. That's it. Okay? Because she just got bit again. And now you're going to have to disguise that bite again so that people don't, you know, glom onto the fact that you're immune. This is so bad. Anybody else would be dead.
Mm-hmm. They really would. But I think it's great to show another instance of Ellie being bit. And I at first I was a bit jarred because I was like, oh, again? Like, it was like she's been bitten 3 times now. Yep. And I was thinking, like, what is the purpose of this choice? And I think this time around it was to show that really Demeanty isn't luck, because
yeah,
the first bite again was a very kind of like flash in the pan one, and we didn't really like see anything take or anything like that with it. Second one, same thing again, it was a bite to the arm, same kind of area as well, so it was like it didn't really stand out. This was a different area, and we also got these horrible little like sinews of tendrils of like, yeah, mycelium like twitching near the wounds as well. So it's almost like definitely had the opportunity to take, but it hasn't. So it's almost like reaffirming that this immunity isn't luck. It's unlikely to be a possibility that Ellie ever does turn if she like gets bit in the future. And I think it was kind of good to really reestablish that. And again, probably for the wider audience who aren't maybe as invested or maybe like kind of have forgotten about the immunity aspect of it, because there's the immunity plays into the story, but it's not really the story. Like Ellie's immunity is a plot, a storytelling device. It's not the story.
No, it's the people. It's the people and the way they react and use this information that's important. But yeah, good to still establish. Ellie is still immune from a third bite. So, God.
So you're saying it was what? Smart?
I'm not saying it could do math or anything, but it didn't run at me. It did what we do. Took cover, planned, waited, lured me in. Stalking.
And you saw this?
Mm-hmm. It was exactly like Ellie says.
And what we're finding is not only are we reestablishing old things, we're introducing new things, because the stalkers are incredibly new to this whole aspect. They are intelligent and they are adapting to everything. And this is being relayed to the council as they kind of sit before a very kind of official, I think it's like an old Wyoming Jackson like county, I guess like council chamber of sorts, and they're retelling the story of how it was tactical, how it was like kind of baiting them in. This is for me the most fascinating approach to the lore of the whole infected, because there are many people, like when you go through the game, oftentimes you'll come across scenes of like runners, which are the kind of like more basic like infected monsters, and they're at times weeping and or like crying or moaning and things, and you're worried, like, is there like a ghost in the shell kind of situation? Is it just like maybe something that's being triggered physically, or are they conscious within there and not able to control themselves while being kind of like forcibly moved? And again, what with this, like baiting in with almost like, again, like crying and things, is it that aspect or is it tactical? Is it making a noise that it knows that humans are likely to respond to because they think someone is in peril, and humans fundamentally will try and help and go towards something like that because they are drawn to it? It's a protective instinct thing, and it's a theme that they picked up on big time last time around about the biological nature of love and how people are instinctively wanting to protect and will do so violently if they have to. And I think it's a great way of like showing that to the audience. This is, for me, I'm so hot on this. I love it.
It really makes the entire world that much scarier, because we know, okay, if you see one infected, you could probably hold your own. You know, you see a horde, a little bit scarier. They're still kind of dumb, so we can at least outsmart them. But now we're establishing that there is a new type of infected that is intelligent and has tactics. That's terrifying, because we're already trying to develop tactics against other human beings in this world. Now we have to worry about these like horrifying infecteds who are actually somewhat intelligent, possibly, right? Like this is so scary. And getting it to be like in a council debrief is so fascinating and makes a lot of sense, given that there's a community, there's a process for things. They've developed, this is the way we do things. And I also love the very small moment I love in this scene is Maria knowing that Dina wasn't there and is lying and didn't see anything. It's just like, yeah, Maria's real smart. You cannot get one past her. So I really loved that small detail of Maria knowing Dina's lying. It's great.
Mm-hmm. And also calling Tommy out on his hypocrisy as well.
Ridiculous.
Just like, how is it different? How?
Because it's
explain
not.
That
it's
to
not.
Me.
You're older? Woohoo.
Yeah.
Does that make your skin thicker, Tommy? I don't think so.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. We also then get a scene of Ellie stitching the wound up. Again, another great way of showing that Ellie is tough. So much so that she can slice into her own body to like mask this wound to make it look a bit more kind of like natural, or maybe like just a kind of gash from something, and does so without really like tearing up, without like screaming or anything, showing that she's a tough one and also can stitch herself up as well.
She's not asking for help. Like, we know there are people who know she's immune. She could ask Tommy, Maria, Joel. There are a lot of people she could go to for help. She doesn't. She does it on her own. And the fact that she doesn't make a single peep while doing all of this, it's just like whooshkies. Like, she can handle pain. She has a very high pain tolerance. So, yeah.
She then starts journaling. We get, which again we see within the game, which is a lovely little kind of way of kind of tracking Ellie's thoughts throughout the events of what happens. We get don't fuck it up, don't fuck it up, don't fuck it up, and barbecue.
And the barbecue, the pun. Dina saying that pun, you're immediately like, okay, they're going to be together forever. They have to be together forever. Please, please, please. Like the puns. Come on.
You can't have a character speak another character's love language and not like have that happen. Like, come on, guys. That would just be too brutal.
Strings are shot. Oh. I'll put some new ones on for you.
Oh, you don't have to do that.
I'll get it back tomorrow.
We get this interrupted with Joel checking on Ellie in the garage and asking if she's attending, but noticing a guitar discarded off to the side. And he gets incredibly upset about it.
Yeah, because it's important to him, right? And he immediately makes the excuse of like, oh, I'm going to restring it for you. And then boom, he's gone. It's like he went in there to have like a conversation with Ellie and try to connect with her. And it feels like he almost immediately was like cut very deeply by the fact that this guitar is very obviously just like thrown to the side. You know, it's not on a stand. It's not being taken care of. Yeah. And it hurts him. And it's so obvious that this is his way of like dealing with it is like, you know, okay, bye. I'm going to restring it. See ya. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a problem I can immediately fix to avoid this. And I can seem as if I am doting upon you. I think as well, like putting the pieces together of knowing what they said last season about how he offered to teach Ellie, and then he gets a bit upset about this discarded guitar, like screams volumes about what he has done to try and fix things in the meantime. And probably before the advice from Gail has come in of just back off and give the kids some space, which again, you can probably sense of like how earnest yet still incredibly overbearing he was probably to try and fix things, which says a hell of a lot about their whole like dynamic.
Maybe they're jealous of you.
No reason to be. I'm not a threat.
Jackson in New Year's, though, it's gorgeous, isn't it? Just the lights everywhere and the sparklers.
It's so beautiful. This has to be my favorite scene of the episode. Just not just the beauty, the way it is so true to the game. And just feel it's you get this real sense of community, right? Like there's a party, there are lights, it's gorgeous. And the Dina and Ellie connection, like there's just so much to love here. My favorite scene. I love Dina just being Dina, dancing with everyone. And, you know, I like the idea of Dina being almost like a, I'm trying to think of the way to word this, like a, people are drawn to her. Like she is a light and people just are like immediately intoxicated by her. And Ellie just, you can see in Ellie's face, like she doesn't feel like she is worthy to be bask in the glow of Dina. And that Ellie, you know, everyone in the room is looking at Dina, and Dina flirting with her and being like, what if they're looking at you? You know, like, what if they're staring at you? And, you know, Dina being high while saying all this, you know, it's, I love it so much. It's, the chemistry is there. It is so true to the game. And it's just gorgeous. The whole scene is gorgeous.
Yeah, we talk about, I said earlier about like the love language of it all, like the puns. I think that's very kind of like surface level one. I think Dina gets Ellie so much in this scene where Ellie like says, like, kind of every guy is staring at you right now. And she goes, maybe they're jealous of you in this whole situation. And Ellie says that she's not a threat. And Dina goes, I think they should be terrified of you. How on earth does Dina know? Like, well, we know how, but like, it's so smart how she gets it that Ellie is someone who is activated by the sense of power and violence and doesn't make it this kind of like taboo of a topic of like, it's something that is kind of like evil. It's just more like that's what kind of makes her tick a little bit. It's so intuitive and speaks so brilliantly to the depth of their relationship that they've built over the 5 years, conveys that immediately. I thought that was phenomenal and such a great point of writing that is ripped straight from the video game. And the faithfulness to the video game of this entire scene. One of the great things from the official podcast and hearing the insights from Neil Druckmann and Craig Mazin is finding out about how much dedication there is to paying homage to the games in a proper way. And Craig Mazin's story about how he was being a bit picky with the crane shot and with the slow kind of like descent down from the fairy lights with this kind of like blur to them. Mm-hmm. And then we get the back shot of like Ellie kind of like standing watching, so much so that like the cinematographer just took it off the crane and was like, right, I'll do it myself. And like took it on. Absolute props for them for that dedication to the skill of the cinematographer Ksenia Sereda, and for Craig Mazin to be that fan behind the helm pushing for this stuff, because I guarantee every fan like us that saw that was just giddy from the fact that it was like the video game was on screen.
Yeah, the shot for shot, it was so perfect, and it sets the scene so well. Like, this is a very important scene to get right, because not only do we have this like lovely kind of chemistry first kiss between Dina and Ellie, but on top of that, we get this moment with Seth, who we all hate. We all hate Seth, where he says a very nasty word when Dina, kids are here, you're in a church. He calls them a really nasty, offensive term. And, you know, Ellie, of course, what did you say? Like, immediately turns around and goes to say something to Seth. And Joel just steps in out of nowhere, shoves Seth to the ground, and is like, get out of here. And yet again, as we saw earlier in the episode, Ellie says, I don't need you to protect me. Like, what are you doing? Like, you're making a scene and I didn't need you here protecting me. And it really kind of amplifies the tension that we've felt lingering between Ellie and Joel to like, it skyrockets it, because this a public place, Ellie is full on just like yelling at Joel about something he did.
It's one thing to have the seeding of this kind of breakdown of their relationship to establish the history and to frame this season, but to, over the course of an episode, slowly seed it in and to have it come to a climax with this scene, phenomenal choice, I thought. A really brilliant one. And especially because the way in which it's played, Joel turning to Ellie almost like for approval, just like asking if she's okay, and she's like, I don't need your fucking help. Like, it's just again, like, it's just so great. I can't gush about it more. It's just so well acted. It's so well written. The choices here at play are very nuanced because there is a difference from the video games in terms of, like, the chronology of it all. And to have this all play out in one story that's contained in this episode a little bit is, again, an effective choice. And it speaks that we don't need a huge set piece finale in the first episode. It's a, like you said earlier, Jess, it's a story about people. And it's reaffirming that this is the heart of it. Yeah, there's going to be spectacle. There's going to be wondrous things that we see. There's going to be horrible things that we see. But fundamentally, someone lashing out to someone they love, that's probably the most profound thing at play here. And that is what is going to be the heart of this story. And so to set that up in the opening episode, brilliant.
And it also sets up that Jackson isn't a utopia. The world still has problems that it had prior to the outbreak, you know, like there are still going to be homophobic a-holes in this world. And some of them are going to be members of like what we like to think of as like this perfect little society. There's still going to be people with like awful viewpoints that live in this world that we have to deal with. And so I like that we also established that while Jackson is idyllic and for this world, it's not a utopia. There are still people with incorrect opinions that live here. So yeah, and I like that they amplified this. I don't think this is a spoiler for the video game to say that in the video game he just shoves Seth, but Seth doesn't like actually fall over. Not in the show, Joel full on knocks Seth to the ground.
Oh yeah,
it was great. Yeah. I'm like, shove him harder, hit him, give him the chair.
Push down all homophobes, like bring on.
Please, but shove more homophobes. That's what we need in this world.
But it's like what you say is absolutely true. Like the departure from the game that we made in the TV show is that the setting was taken back. Infection hit in 2003. Do you imagine that there's been much societal change in this time without like the internet being available, media being available to like show like societal changes en masse, really? Like there probably hasn't been much progression when it comes to society in that kind of front. And so of course these kind of like opinions are going to be long held and still believed. But again, as well, like yeah, we absolutely disagree with this, but equally it's not shoved down the audience's throat of just like, huh, look at this bad homophobe. Like we're all thinking it, but because we can think for ourselves, but it's being presented and it's just showing the reality of what it is. But it's also not satirizing it, like making it performative almost. Like it feels real. And I think that there's a good honesty to that of not kind of just playing into the kind of very drip feedy kind of, you know, virtue signaling that you do get in a lot of media these days. I like the fact that it's still skewed towards a politics that I align with and I appreciate kind of highlighting and sharing, but it's also, it's not patronizing with it either, which I appreciate. Then we get a very significant scene. We get Joel on his porch playing the guitar that he has restrung from earlier, because of course in a couple of hours, like he redid that immediately because it's Joel. He wants to fix the problem straight away. And we get Ellie lock eyes with him and walk straight past.
So painful. So tough. Yeah, it's very painful. She's living in the garage, so she's like not even in the same house as him. And so she is kind of able to just avoid him. And it's really awful. You're just like, please just make up. Please for me. Please. Just do it.
But no, we get more shots of revelers. We get them sparklers in hand, running around town. One of the sparklers falls and it falls upon the pipe that was referenced earlier with the work that the foreman was meant to be foremaning on. And we see the dried roots, and within them we see the cordyceps slowly winding its way in. And then from there, we see Abby's group nearing Jackson under the cover of night. And we realize, oh gosh, it's about to kick off. And the next episode is probably going to be a doozy.
Yeah, we're establishing two real threats to Jackson in Abby's group and Cordyceps. The two threats that exist in this world, people and the Cordyceps, both coming for Jackson. We all should be absolutely terrified of what the heck is going to happen to Jackson and what the heck is going to happen to Ellie and Joel. Like, it's all very scary.
Mm-hmm. I cannot wait for the next episode. I think after everything that's been set up in this episode, I think it's going to be phenomenal. I think we've started off on such a high. For me, this is as good as the season opener could have been. I don't think there's much more I could have asked for it, if I'm being entirely honest. I am kind of like maybe thinking that we could have had, maybe, I don't know whether it would have come later in the episode, but maybe the whole Firefly stuff maybe came a bit more, maybe spread out throughout it. But I mean, that's the tiniest little niggle I have, like the smallest little thing. What are your thoughts on this? Are you as on it as
I am? I think I can't think of much that I would change, honestly. Like, I think you needed this episode to set up where our characters are 5 years after we left them. I think we kind of needed a scene setting, community establishing episode. This felt like a really nice love letter to Jackson in a way. Mm-hmm. And so I like that. I like that we're setting what the stakes are. I don't know that there was much more they could have done in the first episode, unless they were going to do a similar thing with the season one opener of a combo platter of, you know, this event, this was supposed to be two episodes. Let's turn it into a longer first episode. But I think this was kind of a perfect scene setting episode to bring us back into these characters, set up some new characters. All of that was, I think, so well done. They had a lot they had to accomplish in 1 hour. There are a lot of new characters they had to, you know, establish. And I think they did a brilliant job while also still focusing on, obviously, Ellie and Joel, who we all, you know, care the most about. I think they had a lot to do. I think they did it really well.
Gosh. So that probably brings us to the end of our kind of spoiler-free discussions that we've got for this week's episode. If you are spoiler-averse and you're heading out at this stage, thank you so much for listening. And if you enjoyed the episode, we'd love for you to subscribe, leave a review, or drop us a comment. We really do want to hear from all of you, and subscribing certainly helps us out massively, as does likes and comments and all of those other things I'm going to try and push you to do. But if you're still here and you're looking to dig a little deeper into things, and you don't mind running through what happens in the games and what we expect to be coming up, stick around, because spoilers can come up next. Gosh, the fan service from the games and the setup for everything coming is so good. Of course, there is a big lingering thing that we are probably going to be expecting to be next episode, but I kind of want to get the fan service stuff out of the way. Firstly, kind of chiming, we got Gustavo and the band like kind of making an appearance within Jackson. We got the employee of the month dog as
the
well.
The dog, it wasn't a golden like I wanted, but you know what? We got it. I can't complain. That's my one nitpick. Stupid nitpick. What a dumb nitpick. It was incredible. Eugene had a wife. That's incredible. Mm-hmm. Eugene, one of my favorite like unseen characters in the game. I love that we've established that he had a wife, and he still was growing weed, which we also love. That was great. I loved that.
I love the fact that Catherine O'Hara's like husband is Eugene. Like, of course it would be. For those of you who aren't aware, Jess and I cover Schitt's Creek. We do so on a podcast called Talking Shit. Check that out if you're interested. So, of course, the Catherine O'Hara and Eugene connection is big for us, I think. I loved that so much. There was just, again, like, from things being shot for shot, like the Firefly pendants as well. Like, mm-hmm. everything was just so faithful to the vision that we've seen before. And but also, they are taking big leaps and doing some dramatic differences.
They're setting
up, like, Joel and Dina having a relationship together. They're setting up Tommy and Ellie hanging out, like, more. And they bring that a lot earlier into the episode. Because that happens as a flashback, like, later on in the game.
Yeah.
We also get the massive diversion of Ellie walking past Joel at the end. We don't get that conversation.
Yeah, that is truly wild. But I'm excited to see them hopefully revisit it later, you know? Like, I hope we're just going to get, like, a, oh, nope, gotcha, that's not how the scene actually ends.
Yeah.
Later on,
definitely, they've got to be doing that for us who are expecting that scene to happen. It's like we find out that she doubled back, or she comes back a minute later, maybe after, like, clearing her head or something.
It's fine. Like, that's fine to delay us on. I think the biggest change from the video game that I loved seeing was establishing who Abby is earlier, and not hiding the fact that she's associated with the Fireflies. And while it isn't said who exactly her father was.
Yes, I like that.
We know he was a Firefly. We don't yet know that he was the surgeon, but we know he's a Firefly. So we know that there are stakes to why Abby wants Joel dead. I love that because in the video game, that's not evident early on, because you're kind of just forced to play as Abby and wondering, what the heck is this character's motivation? Like, who am I? What am I doing? I think it makes way more sense in a television show, so that we can have investment in this character to be like, okay, this is who she is. This is why she's here. This is what her goals are. She has ties to the Fireflies, and her father was a Firefly. And with allowing us to have that tiny little, the fans of the video game know that he was the surgeon, letting that linger on, I think, makes so much sense. Like, we don't know he was the surgeon. He was the guy. But we know that he was an important guy. So I think that I loved that diversion from the video game. I think it was so smart to do it the way they did it.
Yeah, I like the fact that they tightened up the Salt Lake crew. They boiled it down to five core members. Like, we've got Abby, Owen, Mel, Nora, and Manny. What I thought was fantastic was the setup of the Salt Lake crew, is that all of them have the little, like, leg holsters, except for Mel, which makes her very distinct and non-violent compared to the others. Mm-hmm. Get a bit of, like, tenderness and love towards Abby from Owen, but it's not fully there and stuff, because at this point they've kind of split up. We also get Nora getting quite offended.
No, wait, have they split up yet? I thought they didn't split up until after, because she can't get over the death of her father.
Well, by the time they get Mel's before. Pregnant. So that announcement comes when they get to Jackson, and that's what makes Abby go off on her own. So,
right.
Oh, but this is five years before. This is earlier. Yeah, no, so yeah, no, you're right. Yeah. Because I'm thinking, like,
because there is tenderness, but I think those who haven't played the video game can probably sense they're a romantic, you know, there's a romantic entanglement there. But yeah, it is, and it's very interesting. I'm so curious to see how Caitlin, is it Caitlin Denver's Caitlin? I want to get her name right. Caitlin Deaver. Sorry, Deaver.
Deaver.
I'm very curious to see how she portrays Abby, because we haven't seen very much of Abby yet, but knowing that Abby is very much a brute strength sort of a character, I don't care as much about the physicality as I do the mentality. And I also think it's really interesting, even the height difference. And I know this is, like, such a minor thing, but, like, Owen and Abby are pretty much the same height in the video game. Like, they're very much eye to eye. And I think that, not that it's important, but there is something to, you know, Owen's kind of standing much taller than Abby in the show. And I'm just really curious to see how Abby is going to develop as a character, because she really is this, like, brute strength, like, resilient, just as much as Ellie is, a resilient character. And I think I feel like they got me a little bit with the we'll kill him slowly line, right? Yeah. Like, that, I was like, oh, okay, there's the Abby I know. Yeah.
Well, this is the thing. At first I thought that was incredibly brutal and would frame Abby to be instantly hated, which I'm not gelling with immediately, because I have a soft spot for Abby. Like, I understand her perspective after finishing the game, and I played as her for like so long. So I feel like that's a real misrepresentation, because the slow of it all is, I thought that in the video game that was portrayed more as like in the moment of just, I'm not getting the satisfaction in this thing, which is why I'm going to draw it out. I'm going to try and at least keep hitting him until I feel what I'm meant to feel. And when Owen cuts that off short, I feel like he's done that, because, I mean, firstly, they have a sense of like, well, there are others potentially coming, since Ellie kind of like crashes the party and like does that, so they're going to be on top of them soon. But I think also, because I think he recognizes that like, you can keep hitting him, you're not going to find resolution from this.
Yeah, I guess, and the so, way like, I viewed it is Abby has always, even though she's not said it in the video game, I imagine she's always thought, when I do find him, when I do get to him, when I do have the capability to kill him, I'm going to torture him. I'm going to make it so painful because of how much pain I feel and what he took from me. And so I always kind of felt like she'd always had that in her mind. It wasn't necessarily spoken aloud, but she's always kind of felt that way and felt like, this is what I will do when I get my hands on him. And Owen trying to cut that short pisses her off, because she's waited years to do this and he wants to cut it short. I guess that's how I interpreted it, but I can understand where you're coming from, where it's also a little tough because you are kind of setting up the viewer to be anti-Abby, because she's talking about torturing and killing one of our favorite people on the show. But yeah, I think they're threading the needle is really tough with a character like Abby. But I do think they're doing an admirable job in at least making it clear why she has these motivations. And like, you know, killed her dad, you know, like, I get it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I just think that I was a bit kind of like, ooh, jarred when I first heard it. But I think on reflection, I think that I'm okay with her saying it in the show. Like, I think maybe my perspective is there is a departure from the video game slightly. But on the show, I think what's really great about it is that they are establishing almost like, okay, we're going to start down here, and by the end, Abby's going to be here. Like, there is a real direction for the character progression, because seeing how Abby changes and how Lev will eventually have such an impact on Abby, and like, to get to from like killing someone slowly to like, you're my people and like, I'm going to protect, like, I think is such a huge shift. And I love that we will perhaps maybe get one vision of Abby that's one thing, and another vision that's another, and know that somewhere, perhaps in this season, perhaps in next, there's going to be that journey going through. And so it's like a promise of progression for me, which I love, because I can't see these people throwing this character under the bus to the fans, like throwing them like to the lions almost, without there being real intention behind it. So I have a lot of faith in that. Yeah,
I totally agree. I think they've set up Abby about as well as they could, you know, without really going way too far down the rabbit hole of this character. I think that will come with time. I think they established the stakes for the character, and they have time to establish her as a very complicated character, you know, like, as are most of the, like, I mean, I'll get off my soapbox. It just is like, you can't love Ellie and hate Abby. It just doesn't make any sense. You know, we'll get there, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm absolutely sure we will. Gosh, there's a lot to unpack and digest. Is there anything else that you wanted to review or like kind of circle back on, Jess?
I'm just so happy this show is back. And it next episode, I'm sure, is going to be rough. But I can't wait to be able to just, this is going to sound horrible, I can't wait to be able to be like, Joel is dead! Joel died. Yeah. Like, I just want to be able to say it. It's very Red Wedding-y.
Yeah, it's going to be so freeing. I yeah, this is absolutely making me feel a second bout of appreciation for Song of Ice and Fire fans for keeping such a secret under wraps. Mm-hmm. I've seen a similar amount of diligence. I've seen people lacking on some social medias as well, but I think overwhelmingly the fan base has been incredible at keeping this one close to their chest, especially among like my friend group as well, like where I know some people that don't know it and us who do, and we just shoot each other knowing looks and we just keep making golfing gestures, which is the worst
thing. My gosh, you're horrible, stop.
You've got to maintain the secret how you can, but also we're all in the know.
If we don't laugh, we'll cry.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure we will cry next week. I am really looking forward to it, but that will come next week. But today, we've got to close out this episode, and we're going to do it the way we always have done, by channeling a bit of Will Livingston.
Yes, the barbecue of it all.
So, Jess, in the supermarket, why did Ellie resist making a pun in the snack aisle?
Oh, I feel like I should be able to guess this one. Something about chips. Okay, I don't know. What is it?
Because she had some shelf control.
Stop it.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye-bye.
It's cozy season, and nothing compares to wrapping yourself in a Minky Couture blanket. Luxuriously soft, perfectly warm, thoughtfully made. From movie nights to chilly mornings, Minky Couture turns everyday moments into pure comfort. Once you feel it, you'll understand why it's called the original best blanket ever. Visit MinkyCouture.com or a store near you and make this cozy season your softest one yet.